back for a new series of To FinTech and Beyond, the podcast brought to you by Tribe, which explores some of the biggest, most burning questions in fintech, payments, and financial services. Joining us for the first episode of Season 2 is James Miller, a compliance specialist or authority to tackle the question, is getting a license worth the effort? Hello and welcome. We're back for a new series of To FinTech and Beyond, the podcast which explores some of the biggest, most burning questions in fintech, payments and financial services. I'm Alex Reddish, the MD at Tribe Payments, and today I'm joined by James Miller, a compliance specialist at AuthoraPay. We're going to try and tackle the question, is getting a license worth the effort? So James, welcome. Maybe we can start with a bit of an introduction to yourself and AuthoraPay.
Yeah, thank you for having me. My history in this industry has been a bit of a Forrest Gump story. I seem to have like dotted around nearly everywhere. I suppose the sort of key point probably started in the sort of 2014 time when I was doing operations for BIN sponsorship at Paysafe. And that was kind of the Wild West heyday of like the challenger banks sort of, you know, coming up, right? You had the big names, you had the Revolut, the UPay card, like, you know, Monzo and Sterling were all kicking off. And it was a really great place to kind of see the beginnings of what our industry has become, right? So I did there for while working in operations and eventually like moving into product and then moving through not just card issuing, but acquiring an ATM work with companies like Cashflows. And then about 3 years ago, for my sins, switching to the other side of the coin and moving over to compliance. So it's been really good to kind of see both sides of the spectrum, right? There was always the classic product versus compliance thing, and now I've played both sides.
Rare from someone to go from one side to the dark side. Normally you'd expect it the other way. And so tell us a little bit about AuthoraPay, the compliance process, what your role is and sort of how you're helping the industry.
Sure. So AuthoraPay was originally founded under the basic idea of helping people get financial licenses, you know, predominantly in the UK, and obviously this was pre-Brexit. We did a lot of work in Europe as well. That was largely before I joined. I came on board to expand that into initially card scheme services, helping people become issuers and acquirers in their own right. And since then, we've brought more and more specialists in focusing in different areas of compliance, you know, so we've got the open banking specialists, we have the credit specialists, we have the investment specialists. And we tend to try and cross train now as much as we can, because we never really get a customer anymore that comes on board saying, we want to do one thing, because it doesn't really hold with the industry much anymore, right? They say that, you know, right, we want cards as a standard, but, you know, we want to do payment remittance as well as part of that product. We want to do, you know, stock investments. We want to do open banking services. So we need to now pull in a team of specialists to kind of get that project over the line. And a lot of people come to us with, funnily enough, that core product, right? They come from that product background and they know their audience, they know their market, and they know who they're going after, but they don't know the rules and regs to keep them in track. So we kind of help them on that journey, whether or not it's getting their own license or whether or not it's working under a principal sponsor and seeing how best to make use of that.
Wow. Okay. So taking that kind of umbrella basis, what are the trends that you're seeing at the moment, the startup space in fintech? Like, how do you think that's changing with the current macro environment, you know?
Well, the FCA have a lot to do with it. It's getting a lot harder to get a license. And I think, you know, it's kind of the topic of this conversation, right? Like the FCA produced numbers last year that they rejected 95% of payments, e-money and crypto applications, which is kind of a bit of a tough number to break down, because they grouped all those into ones. Like there was nearly every crypto application got shot down in its first instance. But then you get firms, you know, that got a payment license 15 years ago, who are basically running a garden shed payment remittance service, and they've got their friend who sees them doing it and thinks it's a great idea. And they sort of show up to the FCA with this, you know, half-baked paper application. That goes into like the 95% category.
So taking that 95, because I understood it to be about 1 in 10, so actually it's slightly worse. But then coming into that, notion of the FCA now giving, I think it's a 7-month time frame. I believe that they're working towards now, like this efficiency model. It very much seems like, yeah, we're going to continue to reject a large proportion of people, but those that get it right and have the right quality information up front have a good chance and a good time frame to get that done. That feels like an enabler. Sorry, go on.
No, yeah, that's exactly it. It's that 7-month time frame is something they're definitely trying to work back towards. 7 months at the moment is until your case gets looked at. Wow. And that 95% rejection number is really tough to gauge because there are so many people who are still running on the old way of doing things, especially post-Brexit as well. You've got a lot of people from Europe just trying to set up like a shell company in the UK to continue their business. It's hard to tell within that 95% how many of them are strong applications. So what we're seeing a lot now in the trend is people trying to build a really firm structure before they go to the regulator. And that's getting set up with a sponsor, getting a product out in the market of some kind, so that day one, you know, when they launch with a sponsor or become an agent or a distributor of someone, maybe 6 months later, they then put their application into the FCA. 6 months later after that, it actually gets picked up by the FCA. They look at the application and, you know, previously would say, we're looking to do this, we're looking to work this way. You know, these are the, you know, these are the standards we're going to hold ourselves to. Now it reads like this is what we are doing. This is what we've built. This is the customers we're servicing. These are actual figures, right? This is an actual business. And what we want is to take the agency agreement and replace it with our own license. And that's going down a lot better with the regulator because it's proving these customers know what they're, or it's proving that these firms know what they're doing, opposed to the kind of promises that the FCA can't quite get people to justify.
Yeah.
So that's the change in the industry we're seeing. People trying to put the work in before going to license.
That makes sense. Coming back to the FCA, you know, like if you look at the EMIs and the Dear CEO's letter, I think the last one, 16th of March, I think, in terms of their priorities for payment businesses and operational resilience, it very much seems like they're A, making sure that you can run a business before you take on license activities, but B, then really focus on information, outsourcing, data, general resilience when you get that license. It feels like, yes, they reject 95% of the applications, but also they're probably going to almost terminate a few of those that they previously may be granted based on lack of compliance or technical capability.
So we said it takes 7 months for the FCA to pick up an application at this point, but some applications do get picked up a lot quicker for rejection. And what we're seeing is some case handlers literally looking at the size of an application upload and seeing it's literally one or two documents and just not even reading it, just rejecting it. And the reason it takes 7 months to get to a legit application is because they're just knocking out all these poor applications. Yeah. And I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to minimize how many applications actually come in so they can focus on the stronger ones. Now, this is all speculation, but we're just looking at the behavior we're seeing from the FCA to determine what their plans are. But at the same time, you could have, you know, the FCA making a public announcement about how they're doing one thing, but then all the case handlers and the people actually in the trenches doing the work are behaving completely differently.
Yeah, so, management versus reality.
Exactly, yeah.
So I don't know if you can give me this, but what are the key secrets or things that you need to focus on within that application? Like what are the key differentiators between a good and a bad application beyond proof of existence?
There are a lot of minimums in an application. Classic being a ridiculous minimum that you need a money laundering reporting officer and a director. And those are the minimum requirements for application.
Yeah.
Maybe 10 years ago, that would have been fine, but no one's getting approved on minimum applications anymore. And there's a lot more sort of detailed, you know, requirements than that, but going in on minimums is not a thing anymore. Like you need to go above and beyond. This is why becoming an agent or a distributor is key, because again, you're not coming in with an idea, you're coming in with a reality. And that's kind of like, if there was a secret to getting approved, that's where we're sort of pushing people to say, you know, come in with a real business. Yeah. And it's difficult for some people as well, because if you're coming in without the business operating, you have to be sort of ready and willing to start trading as soon as the FCA flip the switch and say, congratulations, here's your license.
Yeah.
Which means you need to have tech, staff, project, product all up and running. And you need to prove that by the point that your application gets picked up. But if you submit 7-8 months ago and you have everything, the engine running, the money burning, and you're waiting to be picked up by a case handler, you're just burning your resource and burning your investment. Yeah. So it's a lot better to make use of everything you've built and improve upon it in the time you're waiting for the FCA. So there's a financial factor. Staffing is a key one as well. Getting the right MLRO in place, and then asking them to wait around, you know, potentially a year, it can be very different. Like, people's lives change, contracts end up, you know, not holding in. But 7 months' time, they look at the application and say, it says this person is your MLRO. Can we speak to them, please? Well, actually, no, they left the project 4 weeks ago. Here's a new one, you know?
Yeah. So it's a sizable capital investment, isn't it? It seems like beyond infrastructure, compliance programs, actually having 6 to 8 staff, whatever that number is, in order to be relevant to the application. It's not just the whatever it is, $250,000 to capitalize the EMI, but actually it's the other $250,000 you have to spend on staff and infrastructure before that.
Yeah, and then that goes down to the minimum.
So taking that into consideration, and I'm jumping around a bit, but what are the pros and cons then of getting that license? We've talked to cons, I guess, capital expenditure, but like, what are the reasons why one would be happy to get a license?
You become a master of your own destiny, right? Like, working under a principal, working under a sponsor, you know, people have great relationships with their principals and sponsors. They may never want ever to get their own license. You know, they may be happy to put a big chunk of the responsibility on someone else so they can focus on some key features. But any business looking to grow and develop is eventually going to want to try and cut its dependencies, right? There's a big business continuity error with, you know, just look at Railzer most recently, you know. There are so many firms out there that relied on Railzer to trade.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of like Blockbuster right now, and thought it was going to go until it was gone. And obviously they're still in the market, but there's been a big change, and a lot of people were impacted by that.
Yeah.
You know, during that time of trading under Railzer, if any of those agents were to have gotten their own license, you know, they wouldn't be at risk of losing a provider. And again, it's not just the licensing stuff. It's any people building their own tech, you know, becoming as self-sufficient as possible. And then the more you do that, the more value you're adding to your business, which is a key draw for a lot of people. And then you're likely to attract more investment. And your business decisions also aren't second-guessed by someone else. Like, if you want to do something fairly radical and, you know, industry disruption, you don't have to, you know, run it past the parent to say, hey, we've got this great idea, what do you think? And if they don't like it, you really can't do much about it. But, you know, got your own license, running your own destiny, you know, you can really push it. You know, there's a reason why, you know, the big three, Revolut, Monzo, Starling, they never stayed under a principal for very long. They were, you know, they're flagged as the big sort of flagship industry disruptors. You know, they got their own licenses as quickly as possible and started doing their own thing.
Yeah, I remember the founding group, I think it was Focus FS before it became Monzo, something like that. I remember them touting around for pricing, and it was they were looking for like a year contract because they had plans to become a principal, and they basically wanted a free free year. But anyway, they've done all right, so we can't complain. Do you think and you're talking a bit about decision making? So do you think that allows for a better pace of innovation, like the ability to control that destiny? Like, I'm thinking more about technology decision making, like you said, this radical change. It feels like it would enable innovation as opposed to restrict it.
Yeah, of course. You know, we say that you're restricted by your principal or your sponsor, and in turn they are restricted by the FCA. So, you know, they're always going to have to answer to someone, but you're removing those kind of barriers, right? Like, the principal is going to be working within, you know, the brackets of what the FCA allowed them to do. And then just to be safe, they're going to shrink those brackets a little further and stick you inside it as their agent. Yeah. Again, that might be a nice safe space to work, but if you want to widen that scope a bit, you know, you've got to get your own license.
And so for younger fintechs that are licensed, do you think it allows them to become more competitive with the traditional banks, with the sort of, let's call them seasoned fintechs that we're talking about?
Yeah, I would say so. Plus, you know, overheads change. As soon as you drop the sponsor, you're not paying their fees. So, you know, you got slightly better cash flow. Yeah. We talked about the big investment that you need to get set up and get up and running in order to apply. But that's the same level of investment that you would need in order to work as an agent. And then once you take away those overheads, you're still up and running.
Yeah. So then how does a fintech decide what the appropriate license is? There are a number you could apply for. Where does that work? Like, how do you establish that kind of decision-making principle?
Well, what's your product, right? So, you know, the PI and the EMI stuff is really straightforward, right? One of them is focused solely on making payments out to destinations. The other one's about storing funds as e-money for use for other purposes.
Yeah.
We actually do get a lot of people who say, you know, I want to build a financial remittance service, nice and straightforward, but because of their lack of regulatory knowledge, even though they know the market really well, they come in and say, we need an EMI. And we say, actually, no, you don't.
Yeah.
You need a payment institution.
Yeah.
And you have to match the product type with the license type. And another frequent question we get is, oh, well, can we just go for an EMI anyway, though, right? Because it gives us more options. It's like, well, yeah. When you show up to the FCA with your application pack and you say, I want to do a remittance service, so I'm going to apply for an e-money license, they're going to come back and say, well, you clearly don't understand the licenses.
Yeah,
exactly. And they also want to say, why do you want a license? That's a really big part of an application. You have to justify why you're getting this privilege of being licensed to serve the, you know, the UK public and UK businesses. So if you say, I want an EMI license, but you've got no justification of why you want it, they're not going to give it to you. But if you came with a say that I want a payment institution license, you know, then that's valid. And in terms of like the small and fully authorized licenses, that really just comes down to revenue flow, right? The requirements on the application, you know, vary slightly in terms of how strict the FCA are. But on a whole, if you think you're going to be dealing with a payment institution, for example, under 3 million, you know, you want to go for a small license. But if you think you're going to blow through that target within your first month, then, you know, it's going straight in for the authorized.
So that brings an interesting question. So what are the core functional differences in the requirements? So we've talked small PI to PI is revenue. My limited understanding, which is why you're the expert in this subject and I'm not, is that the variation between a payment institution and EMI is around ability to hold funds more than 24 hours.
Yes.
Customer base. So is that one of the core differences? Are there any others that...
It's not so much holding it for 24 hours, it's holding it for a specific purpose.
Okay.
So, you know, you can do a remittance project where you're having funds added to a payment account with a set time, a set destination, and a set purpose. Now, if that goes over for 24 hours, fine. But as long as it hits those criteria and the money goes where it's meant to be, that's the cause. For e-money, you're storing the funds as e-money to be used for a variety of different things. You know, you could do wallet-to-wallet transfers, you could just hold the money, you can add a card to it, etc. So it's about, for e-money, it's about holding those funds. And for a payment institution, it's very much a triggered event. It's a purpose of what you're using that for. That's why it's very common with remittance, because people, they, you know, upload £100 that they want to send off to, you know, the United States, India, wherever. They know that money's going to go there.
Yeah.
So it just, whether it takes 24 hours to be released or 48 hours or wherever.
So the summary is ultimately the EMIs hold money as e-money for a purpose, ultimately. That's what we're talking about, I think.
Well, yeah, e-money is held to be used for a variety of things, whereas a payment account is in place for a specific task. It's a destination. It's a moving flow of funds, right? So it's going to a destination. A lot of people think that you can use e-money as just like a savings account. Yeah, I just want to hold the money, right? We'll just keep it there. But again, you need to justify why the e-money is there, because you're supposed to be able to make it accessible by other systems, right? Whether or not you can do P2P transfers or you can use it to, you know, to buy goods just with another e-wallet, right? You know, C2B payments, or just tap it into a card.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, it's defining that business case for the application is also very important. You do get a lot of people who say that they just want an e-money license almost for the hell of it.
Right.
Because they think it will add value to their business, but they're not just going to give out an e-money license if you don't need it.
And we focused like hugely on the UK, but obviously Brexit forces us to look at dual licensing now in different markets.
Yes.
What are you seeing, or are you able to comment a bit about Europe and where licenses, you know, we had that influx of Lithuanian licenses and that slowed down a bit. Like, can you talk to that a little bit?
Part of an application specifically in Europe is that how you're going to locally service the area and that you're not just using it for a gateway to passporting. So going, even if there weren't other roadblocks in the way, going into Lithuania saying we want a license in Lithuania because we're going to add all this value to the country, and they're just swamped with applications. So they've kind of just developed a whole new localized industry, which is generally fascinating to see as a result of Brexit that you don't tend to see in the news that much. But it also did make a big shift in licenses. Like, people gravitated towards Lithuania because it did at the beginning become the quick win option.
Yeah.
So then now, ever since that sort of slowing down, people were looking for the next big win. They were like, oh, you know, is it France? Is it Spain? Is it Ireland? You know, like, where can we get like the best license? Like, Greece for a while was up there going that we're happy for people to come to us. But as a whole, like, it's that sort of quick win has gone. And even though we're now separate from Europe, the FCA and the other European regulators are now quite common in their approach of, you need to be ready, you need to do it properly. We're not just a gateway to Europe. Like, what are you being here for? They don't want like shell companies. They don't want like a minimum director and an MLRO.
I think that's specific to Ireland, right? Like, everyone thought you could just PO box it, and then it ended up that you had to locate most of your core business there to generate income for the country.
You have to do it properly, and you know, it sounds bizarre. Like, people come to Authoripay for our expertise and our advice. And one of the first things we say to them is that you have to do it properly. They don't like that advice, you know. They're not the kind of people we want to work with. But it's so common where like people are looking for a loophole or to cut corners, and I think it's good that you can't do that anymore.
I it surprises me a little. I think like my perception of the market is a bit like that everyone is looking for a credible EMI now. So it's not that there is a perception of where a good and bad EMI comes from, and therefore actually using someone like yourself or ultimately building a good profile that allows you to become an EMI in a mainland European country or you know, France, Spain seems to be coming up a bit more now. Mm-hmm. Seems to be a common theme, as opposed to, I just want a dirty EMI quick because Brexit screwed me, or actually I want to, you know, throw some money through this to a remittance business in wherever.
It's funny you mentioned France and Spain, because they are coming up more and more, not because the regulator is, we're easy for applications. It's because the market there is developing. So people are now targeting these things. Netherlands comes up a lot, not because it's an easy place to get a license, but it's because a lot of principal sponsors are there. You know, the Currency Cloud, for example, have their license out of the Netherlands. So you become an agent of Currency Cloud, you set up a local office in the Netherlands to run that business. And then when people eventually, you know, graduate to applying for their own license, they do it in the location of their principal. Yeah. So that kind of, you know, grows it that way. A lot of people come to us and say, where's the best place to set up a license in Europe? And our response is, where are you most comfortable?
Yeah. Well, I think that's an interesting point. So as we talked earlier, the innovation pace is not slowing down. So actually the notion of where are you serving your customers and therefore where your EMI license should be is much more aligned. It's less of a, I want to be in the EEA. It's about being localized from a license to a product perspective, that sort of linear association.
Yeah. And you know, people tend to be quite multinational, even in the UK now, right?
Yeah.
So there will be a piece where, you know, we've seen a lot of applications in Bulgaria, funnily enough, because of Paynetics' presence there. You know, it's something that people wouldn't usually think of, but you know, they set up in Bulgaria under Paynetics, and that's where they build out their business and their license. They service all of Europe, but it's right there. And you know, you see CEOs and investors who are Greek or Spanish, and they're like, well, you know, I understand the language, so I can set up my business there.
Yeah.
You know, it's where are you comfortable? Yeah. Where not so much where are you comfortable in terms of where you think your market is, but also where can you legitimately run a business out of? You know, where do you know something simple as like the HR or the tax rules? You know, it's people think about the products and the fintech and stuff, but you actually have to set up a business and have staff and live and work there.
So what would the advice be beyond preparation? Because I think that gives you an easy out that you would give to fintechs to help them successfully get to market.
Besides do it properly.
Yeah. I think that's too easy an answer for
you. Yeah. It's a tough one to sell, but take your time. Like that is something that I really try and tell our clients that they've been working as an agent for a month and they're like, great, when are we applying to the FCA? It's like, get some customers first, like test out your product, like focus on the launch. Don't rush this because we really want to make it as watertight as we can and make you look as good as you can. So that's a really big piece of patience, I think.
Yeah. I think that's right. And coming back to this kind of agent model, I think the VC market, certainly in the UK, Europe, has slightly slowed down. So that let's just do this to get funding to get to the next round notion has gone away a bit. Like the capital markets aren't as positive as perhaps 21, 22. So actually this notion of build a revenue structure, make sure you've got product market fit, and then work out what phase two looks like. You know, that iterative approach rather than big bang approach seems more akin to this new focus on profitability as opposed to customer acquisition.
Yeah, the FCA also aren't too keen on business models that rely on investment. Like, sure, you may want to make a loss for your first year or two to get up and running when you do your projections. But they will point out the fact that, well, if no one gives you any money, how do you survive? And that was something that a lot of firms have been running off for quite a long time.
Even we now as a business perform financial due diligence. We have no regulatory obligation, but just our understanding of the credit risk we're taking by agreeing to a 5-year contract with someone is something that we're, I think, more cognizant about as ever. It's interesting, actually, you know, we've seen, I think, minimal impact of the SVB stuff, but certainly this sort of new fintech is slowing down a bit. It's about how the maturing fintechs can approach licensing a bit more intentionally.
And one of the things that we haven't mentioned is safeguarding. Like that is very difficult to obtain. You know, you have to protect your customers' money to get a license. So you have to get approved by a bank before you apply for a license for safeguarding, and you end up with this like chicken and egg situation, and you can be sitting there for 6 months waiting for a rejection from the bank for a safeguarding account. And they'll make you jump through all the hoops for due diligence and things like that before they just go, yeah, you're not really within our risk appetite, or you're too small, or sometimes they just don't give an answer. And it can be quite difficult and frustrating. Without making it sound too much like a plug, we're working with a company that will provide secure liquid asset investment for safeguarding instead, where I think there's like something like a 3-4% interest rate on the funds. That kind of model might start growing and take over the safeguarding side of things, because people are safeguarding millions and millions, and you know, it's having it sitting there in a bank account that was got horrendous fees or very difficult to obtain. People are moving more into alternative, more innovative ways of safeguarding, which again are approved by the FCA and the other regulators in Europe. But people just never thought of that before until the challenge of getting a safeguarding account came up. So again, innovating by trying to get around the restrictions as things become more difficult and as more barriers are put in the way, you know, life will find a way, as it were. Like, people are looking at more innovative ways to do all kinds of things, whether it's getting a license, building a product, or something as simple as safeguarding funds.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. I think, like, because we have this, coming back to your point about chicken and egg, we have, shout out to our good partners at ClearBank, but like, they wouldn't onboard a non-licensed entity, so you can't obtain the safeguarding account. Same with, you know, someone else. So how do you actually, how do you prove your readiness when you can't actually access the other items that you require for the application?
Again, it comes down to building a relationship and convincing the bank that your application that's gone in is watertight. It's good that you're convinced that you're going to get approved, which isn't easy to do. Yeah, you said, like, some banks, if you're not licensed, they won't talk to you. But then if you need a safeguarding letter from a bank to get a license. But if they won't give you one until you've got a license, it's finding that right partner that's willing to do that. Almost willing to onboard you, you know.
Yeah. So despite all of these news articles about AI taking over the world, we can safely say it's still about people.
Yeah, it will always be about who you know, no matter what industry you think it is. I tell you, if we are talking about AI taking over the world, though, we need to be careful on people spinning up. One of the things the FCA is really strict on is template procedures and policy documents, stuff that's just kind of very generic for the business. And, you know, back in the day, you used to get the same sort of templated AML policies going around the industry, right? Now you can just spin up an AI and say, write me an AML, write me a different one, you know, change these words. You know, and the reviewing process, I can see kind of becoming much more strict on making it as bespoke as possible. Before you just start muddling the words around to say the same thing.
I saw a paper being submitted from a student and they forgot to take out the bit that said it was written by ChatGPT. I think they got caught on that one. But yeah, I think
it's the first FCA application rejected because it says at the top, write me an FCA application.
Yeah, exactly. awesome. Now, we always finish with the same sort of question. We ask every guest that comes on the podcast. So, like, what do you think in fintech is yet to happen?
I'm gonna come in with a rather like doom and gloom projection. Oh. The Great Purge. That's what I think is coming. You know, I'm happy to be wrong, but everything the FCA has been targeting towards within the last three, five years has always been about what happens if you suddenly lose your license. Where's your wind down plan? Where's your operational resilience? Customer vulnerability, making sure customers know what happens if you're no longer available. You know, a paranoid compliance professional may be looking at that going, yeah, like all these things add up to what happens if the FCA suddenly look back on those licenses that are 15 years old and go, are you up to date? No? Okay, goodbye license. You know, are you keeping up to date? You know, and there have been, you know, Rails are, for example, you know, they receive pressure from the regulator. There are other big firms out there, I just don't want to pick on Rails, that are being audited. Like, there is a feeling of like that kind of tightening of scope.
The walls closing in a bit.
Yeah, that smaller firms and even bigger firms that are almost too big are gonna struggle. So that's my doom and gloom projection, that at some point there will be the purge of refining the licensed entities into the, you know, the best, which will be good for everyone. But
like, I do agree. I always talk to it about the tide going out and seeing who's got their pants on, you know, like there's going to be a lot of people that don't. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll start using the purge. It sounds a bit more, a punch to it.
Well, mine sounded very, very murderous. Yours sounded quite comical, so maybe I'll use the pants going out one instead.
So, any final thoughts from you? Where can we find out a bit more about you, about AuthoraPay?
Yeah, website AuthoraPay.co.uk. Google us. Obviously, we're on LinkedIn as well. We've got a number of options available for people looking to become an agent, improve their compliance processes. If they just need a financial crime audit, if they need a recommendation for a great processor, you know, like we've got all these things. We've got our safeguarding solution with our partners, which is probably one of the biggest things we're pushing these days, because it is so difficult. Plus, existing license holders always need to improve that too.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. I think it's been a super interesting chat. I think we could talk for hours now about Europe and the rest of the world and what that means. But I just really appreciate your time. Thanks for sharing your insights.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.